Welcome to Planetary Conversations. I'm your host, Warren Bell. Each week I talk with experienced and knowledgeable guests from all backgrounds and walks of life as we explore ideas and actions that can restore the health of our planet and heal our relations with one another. Check out our website at voiceoftheshoeshop.ca, and you can find all our episodes on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. But first, we openly and freely acknowledge that we live and work in Shukapmakulu, the stolen ancestral and unceded lands of the Suquamish people. We in the settler community have a critical responsibility to do our very best to resolve this historical injustice in a way that is satisfactory to our Indigenous friends and neighbours. Heaven knows the planet and its people need and want peace. Some very prominent national leaders are at present using very unpeaceful means to gain control over their neighbors and or their own citizens, wielding military and economic power and employing violence and the influence inherent in their office to do so. Such approaches can gain short-term dominance, but what happens over the longer term? Why don't we or they choose to practice peace in their or our daily lives? We all want some measure of peace with our family, our neighbors, and our friends, and in the world at large, but we often struggle in our attempts to achieve that goal. To help answer these questions, our guest today is Mike Boudreau. Now, many people in Salmon Arm know Mike as a successful electronics and robotics engineer, founder in 1999 of Tech Brew Robotics, which has designed a successful robotic mushroom picking machine that, in my opinion, could revolutionize worker safety in mushroom growing and harvesting. But today we're going to focus on another aspect of Mike's life. He's a longtime practitioner of Buddhist meditation, of which, in fact, he is now a teacher. And in this connection, he has been involved in establishing, through the local branch of Rotary International, the Shoeshop Okanagan Thompson Peace Builders, or Peace Builders for short, which in turn has led to the creation of a monthly meeting called Peace and Pizza. This combines a shared meal with a guest interview and then a subsequent dialogue around the broad theme of fostering peace. Mike is going to share his work around this and other projects with us today. Mike, it's great to have you here with us in the studio.
Thank you, Warren.
We've been looking forward to this visit because, A, you're in the studio, which is wonderful. But B, I think this is a subject matter that just everybody in the world can relate to. Now, as you, it's clear you're involved with a bunch of community matters, but let's start with Rotary. Rotary International, I did a little looking up of Rotary. It's one of the largest NGOs in the world. It was founded in 1905 in the U.S. And the first club outside the U.S. was in Canada, in Winnipeg, in 1910. But today, there are over 45,000 clubs around the world and 1.2 million members, which is pretty substantial. It's interesting, Rotary also went through an evolutionary process. Up until 1921, they had a kind of a unspoken color, you know, ban. And then that was dropped in 1921. And then up until 1980, there still were no official women members, but that has also changed. Why don't you talk a little bit about your involvement with Rotary when it started and what your experience has been with that organization?
Well, I was laying on a beach one August down near Soyuz.
This is the beginning of a good story.
And I had this, I think it was Shuswap Market News or the Lake Shore News. It was one of the newspapers that don't exist anymore. And, you know, I've rarely had time to read the paper, but I was flipping through the paper and here's an ad for a group study exchange to India being hosted by Rotary. I had no idea who Rotary was. I had no idea what a group study exchange was.
How long ago was this? Roughly.
20 years ago. And so it was 1999, actually. So 26 years ago. Anyway, I wanted to go to India. So I threw my hat into the ring and ended up going to India and spent 6 weeks traveling through Maharashtra state, primarily, and hosted by Rotarians, and seeing what Rotary was doing for the needy people in India, people without water, without adequate food, without education, healthcare. And I was moved by the humanitarian work of Rotary, and I decided I wanted to be part of that. Rotary's motto, service above self, definitely resonates with me, as does their value statement, which is the four-way test, which basically says, is it the truth? Is it fair to all concerned? Does it build goodwill and better friendships? Is it beneficial to all concerned? So if you live by that motto and those four value statements, how can you go wrong, basically?
Indeed.
But, you know, Rotarians, as you pointed out, is made up of 1.2 million people. And people don't always remember or understand
yes.
what those words mean. So
sure.
So it's like any human institution. It's got strengths and weaknesses. So
to me, it seems like a strength if you can say, no, we think we need to do things differently. Let's change what
Absolutely.
We do. That seems to be a powerful subtext, if you like, to
Absolutely.
What's going on.
Yeah.
The first, when you read about Rotary, the first line says to promote peace.
Mm-hmm.
But it's practical. It's not promoting peace by giving speeches. It's promoting peace by what you just described, going to a place where people have a need and then trying to fulfill that need. There's a term that's used in Rotary, which when I first heard it about 20 years ago, it stuck in my mind and it will never, ever go away. Sweat equity. Why don't you describe what sweat equity means and how it eventuates in real terms?
Well, I mean, Rotary is, if you condense it all, it's really about giving back after you've realized benefit from the community that supported you to get to where you're at. And so sweat equity is getting your hands dirty, helping others, basically. Rotary was instrumental in the forming of the League of Nations and the United Nations. The UN Charter of Human Rights mm-hmm. was drafted by Rotarians with Eleanor Roosevelt.
Mm-hmm.
These are very meaningful, big actions. But just walk around our community and look at the water parks and the Peace Park and the nature trails and Rotary is involved in making this a better place to live. And I think we need to really extend that a bit deeper, because the lack of harmony that does exist in our very peaceful community needs to be addressed full on.
Indeed.
And that kind of flies under the radar, even of most Rotarians, I would say, right now. So
I remember when the Peace Park was being built, if you want to call it that, the turf was being laid by a bunch of industrious Rotary members and Canadian Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear. We got our name on the sign, mm-hmm. but all we did was put some panels, they're quite lovely panels, around in the garden area with quotations from people about peace.
Mm-hmm.
But I remember looking at the how much work the Rotarians were doing, and we just plunked these things in the ground and away we went. And
there's the sweat.
That's right. You guys were doing the sweat in real terms.
Yep.
Now, another part of your sort of life fabric has been the Buddhist teachings.
Mm-hmm.
And you described the particular kind of Buddhism that you've been involved with called Kadampa Buddhism,
mm-hmm.
Which is part of the mainstream of Mahayana Buddhism, which is the central teaching where most Buddhist traditions are founded. And it began for you in a time of crisis when, in 2008, things were really difficult for many people. I know many other people who had, especially who were running a business, had real difficulty and things just fell apart. In that time, you describe having 50 employees in your work, and it went right down to 3. Just lay out how dark that felt for you, as well as the world around you. It seemed to be just imploding in many ways.
Yeah, actually it was 2010. 2008 is when the recession really kicked in, and it wasn't until 2010 that it caught up to us. Mm-hmm. I mean, right up until August of 2010, we had customers saying, we love the project, the return on investment's there, we're going to do it. And then, all of them basically end up saying, you know, this is dragging on longer than we expected. We're going to sit on our cash. And so, yeah, we had to turtle, basically pull ourselves in. And when you put your heart and soul into something, seeing it die, or, you know, facilitating its death.
Yes. right there with it.
Is very, very, very difficult.
Yeah, for sure.
And I had a lot of attachment, like my sense of self-worth was attached to the business. And
what was it like seeing employees having to tell them, I'm sorry, we just can't keep
it? It was heartbreaking. Yeah. I mean, everybody I hired with the intention of it being a life. Mm-hmm. Life engagement, basically. And that was kind of my level of commitment to them. And then to have to break that commitment was really hard.
No, I think a lot of people, I know other businesses which went through exactly the same heartbreak. It was a heartbreak. It wasn't just in a small town, you're running a business with people you know, and people you get to know and people you care about. It's a whole different thing from, you know, a corporate head office somewhere far away saying we've got to downsize and sending out a...
They're not numbers. They're not replaceable. You know, the current context in big business is we need this job function filled. Somebody has that label. We'll plug them in there. Yeah. And if we don't need that anymore, we discard them. That's, very dehumanizing. And that's not the way that... My business is more about family. It was a family kind of experience. So.
Now, you were part of Rotary, and then you stepped away. It was obviously such a devastating time that Rotary didn't even seem to have the answers.
I didn't have the capacity even to attend to my family well, let alone spend time giving back to the community. So, about 2008. I joined Rotary in 2000, and I stepped away in 2008, and wasn't until my rebound in, I guess, 2011 that I rejoined.
So talk about the new heart of wisdom, profound teaching from Buddha's heart. I did my research.
Well, new heart of wisdom, I received an email saying, hey, you should go to this meditation course. There's this Buddhist monk coming to town. And I thought, yeah, that's interesting. And about 3 months later, I was reminded about this ongoing course, this meditation opportunity. And I decided to go. And of course, my radar is on 300% because, I've looked at a lot of belief systems and whatnot. Mm. And witnessed or saw the manipulation of people by people with those belief systems. Right. And I wasn't interested in that. Sure. So I was going in with the idea of, am I walking into a cult or some brainwashing or that sort of thing? And this monk, Gen Sandin, who traveled up from the coast, gave this meditation class. And in part of the meditation class, he said, Buddha said, don't take my word for any of this. Try it in your life. If it works for you, use it. If it doesn't, let it go. And I went, whoa.
That's
not brainwashing and that's not cult. I want to learn more. And so I went up to the monk afterwards, Gen Sandin, and said, okay, so which of these 23 books would you start with? And he handed me The Heart of Wisdom. And so The Heart of Wisdom is basically the core teaching of Buddha. You need to spend some time meditating to get to start to realize even an inkling of this. But basically, it's the idea that everything that we see and perceive is our perception, full stop. Mm. And the mistake we make is that we think that it's real. Mm-hmm. And by treating our perceptions as reality, we cause immense harm. And the most harmful thing that we do, and all of us basically do this, and it takes a while to train our mind out of this, is that we see ourselves as separate and more important than anybody else around us. So it's called self-grasping and self-cherishing. Mm-hmm. And it's the self-cherishing mind that when you follow the continuum to the extreme, you see international wars and bombing of people, theft of other people's resources, call it extractivism. You had Luke Kemp on here previously. He kind of nailed it in that, if we were treating each other fairly, we wouldn't be wrecking the environment and creating all kinds of psychological damage, trauma to each other. And, these traumas don't just stick to the person being traumatized. They're passed on over generations, as we see with Indigenous peoples and even people that, survived World War II, for example. There's Dutch mothers who were studied that were pregnant during the World War II. And three generations later, there's evidence of trauma in the offspring of those grandmothers. So
the teaching that you embraced, in addition to showing and illustrating and describing and learning about the teaching of Prince Gautama, who we eventually was called the Buddha, but that was actually quite a long time after his death. But it's interesting that that means the enlightened one. And,
right.
And that's no question that everybody knows what that means now. But the form of Buddhism that you became involved with was very, very much a pragmatic approach. And there is a pragmatic side to Buddhism. Well, we'll talk about that later. But the point was to use the teachings to transform your daily activities, so what you do on a daily basis.
Correct.
And one line from a description of this particular form, Kadampa, was that the goal is to embrace a joyful and profound spiritual path for your whole life. It's not just to learn about it in a book. It's something where you apply it in a practical way. Now, what you're saying, and I think is very important about what we're talking about today, is that peace is not just an external thing, it's also an internal thing. Why don't you talk about that nexus of internal and external?
Sure. Well, Prince Siddhartha, who was Buddha before he attained enlightenment, grew up in a sheltered imperial compound. Mm-hmm. And because the king had been told that his son had great compassion and that if he saw suffering, he would not become king. And so whether you call it soothsayers or whatever, so the king sheltered him until he's in his 20s. And when he went out of the compound for the first time and saw babies and elderly sick and dying and, animals and people dying in the street and whatnot, his compassion moved him to seek enlightenment. And so that's actually the principle of the Mahayana path, is we're looking to relieve others' suffering. And so that's the motivation. And to attain that motivation, we need to attain enlightenment. So we need to basically free ourselves from suffering and to be happy so that we can help others. It's kind of like learning how to be a lifeguard at the swimming pool. How do you help somebody that's drowning, right? You need to learn how to swim a bit yourself. So that's
good idea.
That's the core of it. And if we're always making this mental mistake through self-grasping, we need to change that. And that's a very deep habit. And the only way that we're going to change that is in our daily life. So the purpose of meditation actually is to familiarize our mind with a different way of thinking, so that when we're out of meditation, we're thinking differently.
Sure. Yeah.
And the different way of thinking is about always trying to do things that are going to lead towards happiness for ourselves and others. And to avoid causing harm, because when we do anything negative or harmful, we're causing suffering, not just for ourselves, but for others. And karma is a very useful tool in the teachings of Buddha, because it basically says, whatever I put out, I get back. whatever goes around comes around.
Yes.
And you know, we all kind of know this innately, and we like to use the words karmic when something really good happens. But it's functioning all the time. It's like gravity. It just functions.
Yes.
And if we all had a realization of that, our behavior would be way different. It'd be way better than what we see today.
So. I always, at the end of a major sporting event, especially football seems to be a place where this happens, somebody will go down if they win a victory on their knee and say thank you to some deity. And I often wonder why they don't do that when they have a horrendous defeat. They don't go down on their knee and say thank you for this important lesson that we have learned. It's right. Helped us understand humility.
Well, that's the other part of Buddhism, is everything that we experience can be transformed. And actually, the biggest learnings are like when you have to shut down your company.
Oh,
it's when you're down in the mud that you're most willing to say, what do I need to change about me?
As a psychotherapist, primary care psychotherapist, people don't come to tell me, I'm feeling really good. I just want to talk about it some more. They come, they say, terrible things are happening. I don't know what to do. Yeah. Your background before that was in engineering. And engineering is the ultimate left brain. All you have to do is remember what the engineering students used to do on campus at UBC. They didn't think of the consequences always. And yet meditation is reaching into all of your consciousness, including the right brain, which is increasingly characterized as having different qualities. What was it like for you to go from a discipline that is very much intellectually oriented to a practice that is much more inclusive and involves other parts of your consciousness? What did that feel like for you?
It was liberating. Mm. I mean, And Buddhist teachings are scientific methods.
Absolutely.
And a scientific method means if you do X, Y, and Z, you'll get result B, mm-hmm. right? So as long as you follow the formula, you're going to get the result. So that resonates with the engineering mind in me. it's explained very clearly. And just reading a book doesn't do it. You need somebody that with the experience kind of to unpack it and help you along. It's called Sangha or teacher or guru or whatever. I read a book by Trijang Rinpoche, I think, before I started meditating in the new Kadampa tradition. And it read well, but it didn't affect my life. Mm-hmm. I didn't know how to put it into my daily practice of life. And then when I came to these meditation classes, now I had people who knew how to show me how to do that. And so
You would have changed too, because you had been brought down. The sort of material world had some important parts of it had sort of evaporated while you were watching it. It was very painful.
Yeah, it was quite painful. And so in the right brain, left brain context, the right brain really needs time, space, and quiet to contemplate what's going on. The left brain and right brain really don't communicate well together. Great to hear Ian McGilchrist on this mm-hmm. Channel at some point in the future. Yes. But he's a very good theories on this, and basically the piece of our brain that connects the left hemisphere and the right hemisphere is inhibitory. It's not transmissive. Mm. It's saying
the corpus callosum.
The corpus callosum. Yeah. It's saying I've got this. Leave it alone. So one hemisphere tells other hemisphere to do that, and so all of our language, which is the way that we get to convey ideas with each other, is the left hemisphere brain function. Mm. And whereas all of our feeling and engagement with the world around us, our big picture part of us is in our right hemisphere. Mm. So if we want to progress ourselves, we really need to develop our right hemisphere. But all the words are coming into the left hemisphere. And the only way we get the transfers to sit still with information. And so, you know, just to read a book or to even attend a teaching and not put it into practice, it's like going to the doctor and getting a prescription and getting the prescription filled and then leaving it on the counter. If you don't put it into practice, it's meaningless. It's just knowledge, right?
My own practice, that I offer suggestions to people. You know, they're only suggesting they can adopt them or not. And I have a feeling when they hit the street, it's like that? I'm not sure I want to do that. And away they go to the old habits, because that's what we do. We're very habit bound.
Absolutely.
You also were involved for a while with the Pursuit of Excellence yep. program. Why don't you describe, like, compare and contrast Buddhist teaching with Pursuit of Excellence in terms of what they offer and bring about?
Well, the Pursuit of Excellence, that was put on by Context Associated, which was formed by Randy Revelle, who's now passed. And the Pursuit of Excellence actually was the second course that Randy provided. Randy, before he started Context Associated, was involved with, I believe it was EST, which is Eckhart Tolle.
Yeah.
Eckhart Tolle. And prior to that, he was a venture capitalist analyst in San Francisco. And as a venture capitalist analyst, he was very curious about what made a deal fundable and those that aren't. And it wasn't so much the technical business plan, it was the people presenting the plan and said, okay, what characteristics do these people have that the other ones don't? And are those teachable? And so he put together a retreat course called The Wall. And basically The Wall helped the participants figure out what mental obstacles they had that was preventing them from proceeding further in their success, whatever their definition of success was. Mm-hmm. They got clear about their definition mm-hmm. of success, and then, okay, what are the walls stopping me from realizing that? And then how do we break through them? So that was The Wall. And he offered it to CEOs of companies, and they thought it was great. And they wanted family and friends to have this opportunity as well. And so that was offered, and Randy realized that the friends and family didn't have the same level of introspection as most CEOs had. So the Pursuit of Excellence was developed to develop that introspection. And so it was 21 mirrors, basically, of how to look at what's going on in our mind to figure out what's going on for us and how it's working for us or not working for us. And so anyway, that whole series was super powerful. And again, it was quite liberating, and it opened my mind to different ways of thinking. Prior to that, if I was offered a Buddhist meditation course, I don't think I would have engaged, or if I did, I wouldn't have followed through.
Isn't it interesting how we have an internal vocabulary? Mm-hmm. And the internal vocabulary is where we store the meanings of specific noises we make with our vocal cords. Mm-hmm. And they trigger certain kinds of responses. And the habitual nature of this, which is habits are necessary. I mean, the habit of meditation is a very good habit. Somebody once said, we all have habits to do everything. And just we trade them in for better ones when we start to see things working in a better way than the way we're doing it right now.
Yeah. So 99% of our consciousness is not dedicated to conscious thought. Less than 1% of our capacity is conscious thought. So what's other 99% doing? It's all habit. Like we're not extremely mindful when we're doing almost anything in our life. And so if we want to change what's going on in our life, we need to change our habits. And the way to access those is through meditation. So
all of us also come from somewhere. We mm-hmm. come from a physical orientation. We're born. We are a woman born. And in everybody's background, there are patterns that express themselves later on. Mm-hmm. What you said when we were talking about your parents, was that they were atheists and mm-hmm. perfectionists, and meaning that they weren't people who explicitly focused on sort of religious affiliation. But you said, I was never an atheist. Why don't you describe what was in you that brought that sensibility, if you like, to the surface.
I don't know if they were atheists. I'd say agnostic for sure. But yeah, no, I had this innate curiosity in it. And it, when I was a kid, I had friends that were going to church on Sundays, and we never did that as a family. And I was curious what they're up to. Mm. So I tagged along and
And what did you find? What sorts of things did you find? Because it wouldn't be just one thing.
Well, not just as a kid. I mean, times I spent in church afterwards were for weddings and funerals. And usually there's some teaching or sermon, whatever, however you want to label it, that went along with those. And I realized that the core teaching or value often was quite good, but the baggage that went around with it and it seemed like the purpose was for one person to control another or a group of others. Mm-hmm. Just I found off-putting.
and that's a particular burden that's been attached to Christianity. At a certain point, it went from being the teaching of a great teacher to being a state religion, and state operations require police and rules and regulations.
Hijacked by the Romans. Absolutely. But, you know, Christianity isn't the only formal institutionalized religion that's guilty of that. Mm. And so, you know, I read the book by Susan, I forget her last name right now, it's called Lying. And in there, she quoted a Jewish scholar who said that the core teaching of the Talmud was to do no harm. Mm-hmm. And the rest of the Talmud was commentary on that teaching. Since then, I've been having conversations with lots of people. And when they say, okay, I follow this this wisdom path or belief system, I say, oh, what's the core teaching of that? So a Christian, I'd ask, what's the core teaching of Christ? And I'm surprised how many times I get the deer in the headlights. Like, what do you mean core teaching? And anyway, asked Jenny Carter that, and she said, oh, that's easy. Love everyone. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, that's perfect. Because if everyone means all living beings, mm-hmm. that's the same as Buddha's core teaching, mm-hmm. love all living beings, which means wish for their happiness. Mm-hmm. So what's the rest of the Bible then? Well, it's commentary on the core teaching. And where things really get hijacked is when some of out of context parts of the commentaries get used for whatever purpose, usually to go and steal something from somebody else.
Further a worldly goal.
Exactly. You know, worldly goals. That's when religion has been abused. And that's why, you know, people that are, you know, stepping away or diminishing their engagement with religion, that's why they're doing it. And it's perfectly understandable. So.
What you mentioned earlier about the teachings of the Buddha were that all the things we see are our perceptions, not reality. And in fact, it extends to our own personality and our self-assessment. Who mm-hmm. are we? Well, we have an idea of who we are, but it's an idea, and the idea changes as we evolve in our awareness of things. And it's generally accepted, I think, among scholars of comparative religion that Buddhism is the most psychologically oriented of all the world religions, simply because it focuses on what actually goes on inside people, as opposed simply, you know, do good works, you know, behave in the right way. As you described it when we first brought it up, that it was liberating. How did it liberate you? What kind of specific liberation did you experience?
Well, if what I'm perceiving is just my idea, that creates a lot more freedom. As soon as I lock in and say that's reality, it excludes infinite possibilities. You know, and just to put a bit more context to this, there's another book that I read recently called Tricks of the Mind. And basically this author indicates that we engage with the world through our senses. And the sensory data coming in is very noisy and it's not coherent. And so our mind is continuously hypothesizing. It's trying to say, what's the best fit for this information that I'm receiving? And it grabs on that hypothesis and says, okay, this is reality. It's just a hypothesis. It's an idea, right? So as soon as we realize that we're dealing with ideas rather than chunky objects, we have a lot more freedom.
Yes. Yeah. And that is one of the fundamental goals of Buddhism, and probably one might even say of all spiritual teachings, is to be free to be who we really are, as opposed to the multiple hypotheses that we have embedded in us. You described your parents as perfectionists, and I wonder if there was also something where you could say, okay, there isn't a perfect way, there isn't the right way, there isn't, you know, this way that things have to be done. The way changes as you go one step at a time. It's always changing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, what's perfectionism? I mean, it's one person's rule or perception of how things should be, and we all know that one size doesn't fit all. So,
one thing you told me about when we were speaking before, which struck me, was that you had an experience where your phrase was, my heart melted. Mm-hmm. When you saw a couple, a Syrian couple, having a difficult time in a Timi. Just talk about that, because it's kind of emblematic of what we're talking about, seeing induced pain that wasn't necessary.
Yeah, that. So I'll just back up a bit, a step from that even. Tech Brew Robotics, we hired people from all over the world. If you go up to the campus where we had the business, there's a UN flag on the flagpole. And I've been questioned about that a number of times. And I've had a number of people that I hired into the community that were obviously not white Anglo-Saxon Protestant people that were screamed and yelled at to go back to where they came from. And when this happened to a family, a young family here in town, and I heard of the story, my heart melted, because the family came, they left Syria because there was a bomb hole where the home and the mother were moments before. And so I realized that, you know, everybody does their best in the moment. Everybody does their best in the moment. And we have to hold that in our heart. And if, so if somebody's acting in a negative, bigoted way towards others, there is a lack of understanding in their heart. And so how do we get people to be curious about each other and learn their stories so that we don't say things that are harmful like that? Because if the people that were inflicting the pain on this family through their behavior knew their story, I don't care how hard your heart is, how would you tell somebody to go back to a bomb crater, right? So that really became motivation to say, okay, what can we do about that? And I'd say the peace building work that I've been doing over the last few years has been all around, how do we build community? How do we get people to be, rather than fearful of each other, be curious of each other and learn each other's stories, which really humanizes each other, right? We, with our labels and our, you know, our nuclear family households, we're so separated and isolated, and we think that social media brings us together. It really doesn't.
No.
If anything, it drives a bigger wedge. So we need to find ways back together. And, you know, Luke Kemp in Goliath's Curse, who we interviewed recently, talked about, you know, the hunter-gatherer tribes and how cohesive and inclusive and what's the
collaborative
word? Collaborative, egalitarian.
Yes, egalitarian.
There was no paternalism. There was no maternalism. Right. It was the, you know, the strengths.
Everybodyism.
Played. Everybodyism. Yeah. Yes. And so what we see in the world today is people, you know, Scott McKee, I had at Peace and Pizza, said whenever he looks at a news article, the first question he comes to mind for him is who benefits from this? So I encourage everybody just to adopt that question. Who benefits from this? And it's very telling, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. It's revelatory. Now, there's no better way to bring peace on earth than with pizza. I want to be clear about that. So why don't we talk a little bit about peace and pizza? I mean, it is a combination that is absolutely irresistible. Mm-hmm. Of course, I'm being a bit facetious, but there's something about breaking bread together. It's mm-hmm. mentioned in lots of teachings mm-hmm. that having a meal together is a profound way to come to, I don't know, uniting ourselves through the joint functioning of our separate digestive system. Right. They all work the same way, and they all, when reading something we enjoy, it calms us. Mm-hmm. Every mother knows that about an aberrant child who's offering around like a fool, that a little food will just act as a nice sedative. So peace and pizza. Now, the initial establishment of it was a bit of a group effort. You mentioned Jenny Carter, Jane Harding, mm-hmm. Mary Scheidegger, and Brian A. How did this genesis come about?
Our Rotary Peace Committee was looking for what can we do to create peace in the community and peace. I ask everybody, what does peace mean to you? And you get all kinds of different answers. But if you talk about social harmony, increasing social harmony, that's really what we're kind of focused on. So we're looking for collaborative projects. And I reached out to all the churches, basically, in Salmon Arm and other institutions to say, what are you doing and how can we help you? And is there some new idea that you're not doing that we could be doing together? And it was in a discussion with Jenny Carter and Mary Scheidegger one day where I think Mary came up with the term peace and pizza and thought it would be a movie night where we had pizza and watched a movie about peace. And it was right around that time that Brian Ayotte related the story of the Syrian family to me. And I started going to the Wednesday lunch at the First Community and getting to learn people's stories that, you know, really relied on that lunch and how brilliant and human they were. And that everybody, you know, ideally would have the opportunity to listen to other stories. And so that's how Peace and Pizza came about. We when people arrive, they're invited to sit with somebody that they didn't know before and learn their story. And they could start off by sharing what peace means to them as part of that storytelling.
You know, it's interesting. The one psychological truth is that storytelling is one of the most powerful ways for us to link with each other. And it is, in fact, I think Luke Kemp called it sort of our superpower, mm-hmm. the ability to say, this is what happened. Mm-hmm. This is what I did. This is what happened to another. And then the other saying, well, this happened to me and mm-hmm. that's what happened to me. And joining them all together in a big whirlpool and then picking out the parts that work for you is something that makes us as humans, our animal cousins don't have that capacity. And but we have the capacity to approach them out of this place that we have created in ourselves. So right. it's a linking process that's really powerful.
Yeah. And you know, any strength overplayed becomes a weakness. Mm-hmm. And what we're seeing today is that storytelling strength being hijacked by the entertainment industry. So you know, if you ask anybody to do anything today, I'm too busy. Okay, how are you spending your time? And we're spending so much time and money on entertainment today that we don't have time to connect with others. And that's a weakness.
And even more powerful is the storytelling that is motivated by a sense of gain, a direct, unmitigated, unvarnished sense of gain. When watching television, or not so much listening to radio, but even the commercial station falls into this pattern, and that is that you have content, but the real content in terms of sort of the material survival of the communication medium is telling you a story that is a false story about something that will generate you in you a desire to make a purchase.
Correct.
And it's interesting, a typical television program starts off with long gaps between sequences of ads, and the gaps get shorter and shorter and shorter. By the time you get to the end, it's like 1 minute of program and 2 minutes of advertising. Right. And the commercialization of things, which is distortion, it's an inevitable distortion, has become so acceptable that it desensitizes us to truth-telling, where you say to somebody, I am in pain, mm-hmm. and they say, tell me more, and then you tell them what really happened, as opposed to something that somebody gussied up to look like something else.
Right. So the marketing gurus have really hijacked our innate and unending desires, which Buddha related to attachment. Attachment is a deluded, a negative mind. It'll only cause harm.
Yes.
And that's where we attach our happiness or our perception of happiness to things outside of ourselves.
Just for listeners, there's a wonderful little book called Zen Flesh, Zen Bones, and it's stories from the Buddhist tradition of individuals, many of them are monks, but not all, going through very trying experiences and saying, well, that's what happened. Mm-hmm. And then when at the end the trying situation is relieved, they say, well, that's what happened. In other words, they're floating through without attaching themselves to this rock or this wall or whatever it might be.
Yeah, patient acceptance. Yeah.
So when you started Peace and Pizza, how did the final format come about? It was originally sort of watch a movie after having pizza, but you now have live people.
Yeah, so to get people's attention, you need a drawing card. So the idea was we'd have a speaker, an interesting speaker, tell their life story. Mm. So Louis Thomas was our first speaker, and all the work that Louis and his mother had done over the years, we felt deserved a Community Peace Ambassador Award. And so we gave him the first Community Peace Ambassador Award at that Peace and Pizza. And because the work that he and Mary did to build bridges has just been amazing, mm-hmm. and continues to be amazing, and deserved recognition. So, and then having him tell his story about what he went through over his life, he was brought to tears, and a lot of the audience was brought to tears, mm-hmm. as well. And then, yeah, just we have people from the mainstream, like we had Al Harrison, the mayor, speak as well, and Scott McKee, an internal physician. Mm-hmm. But we really look for the least understood parts of society, people that represent the least understood parts of society. And I'd mm-hmm. say that's all of us, but where it really shows up is around indigenous peoples, homeless people, mm-hmm. food insecure, mm-hmm. Sexual identity, people with sexual identity, immigration and racism. Let's understand each other, and by hearing each other's stories, the labels get reduced, and we really start to see the human, and that's what we need. That's the recipe to peace, I think.
I think it'd be hard to find somebody who disagreed with that sentiment. It's a pretty powerful way of restoring our, if you talk of restoring humanity, mm-hmm. in us. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what it takes, is hearing each other's story. Mm-hmm. And sometimes the difficult stories are the stories that teach us the most. Mm-hmm. Now, there's lots of things that we haven't talked about, but that are part of what you're doing. Rotary is, you're back in Rotary. Rotary is backing up the work you're doing. It fits, it seems to me, 100% with the ultimate purpose of Rotary. What about in your own life when you were going through these challenges? How did they affect how you could, you know, you have several children, you have some lovely children, one of whom has fallen into the spell of becoming a family physician. What is it like to see and to change as you change, to have a change in your relationship with your children, with your family? Because there's so many levels in which a change in us eventuates in the world around us.
Yeah, well, do as I say, not as I do. You know, a teacher, a
parent. I always call that a desperate attempt by people in positions of authority or parenthood to say,
exactly,
I can't stop myself doing this, but please don't do it.
Exactly.
Please don't.
So it's not just a parent-child relationship. It's all of our behavior affects everyone around us. Mm-hmm. And we are all learning continuously from each other. And this is most apparent in a parent or caregiver role relative to a child. And, you know, if you say one thing and do something different, guess what the child learns? What you do mm-hmm. is what sticks. So, and then if you say, okay, what's my legacy in this life? It's the people and how they behave that follow us. And so what kind of legacy do I want to leave? And so I need to be the best version of what I can potentially be for the benefit of those that are following me. And so when I've arrived at this realization, you can interview my kids and they say Mike version 1.0 versus Mike version 2.0, pre and post Buddhist meditation are different characters, and we really like 2.0. Thank you very much. So.
I came to my first peace and pizza gathering, and I happened to sit at the same table with your son.
Yeah.
And he said exactly what you just said now. It's the softening of the edges around the hard lines that are implanted in our brains. There's a quotation at the beginning of a book I read recently from Carl Jung, who went through a psychotic break, and he wrote a book called Memories, Dreams, and Reflections, and it's a story of his experience. And what he said in that book, I may not quote it exactly, he said, the more I sort of disintegrated in terms of who I was the more I felt in kinship with all other life forms.
Yeah.
Does that resonate with you in any way?
Absolutely. I mean, you said show up... you know, allow people to show up as who they are. Even the person that we think that we are is an illusion. So the more we can let go of those ideas of locking ourselves in to be in this or that or the next thing, the more liberating we are, and the more that we get to see that everybody's in the same boat. We're all in this together, which is, by the way, the Global Happiness Index has just been published. Finland, I think, has been number one on that happiness index for 7 or 9 years now. And the primary reason for that is they have this attitude that we're all in this together. Imagine if we had that attitude, we're all in this together. I mean, they got a superpower on their doorstep that'd like to eat them up. So we're all in this together.
They also have
any parallels there?
Yes. So many parallels. We couldn't really track them. We would spend hours here. They also have a really advanced child raising system outside the family itself. Mm-hmm. Nobody is allowed to teach children unless they have in-depth understanding of childhood parameters and developments and evolutionary changes. They spend a lot of time outdoors and they spend a lot of time with each other. Mm-hmm, there's a lot of social time as well.
In the sauna.
Yeah, yeah, in the sauna, yes. Which is a very interesting social time. You come
business, up. Business is done in the sauna in Finland.
So. Yes, indeed. That's not a bad place to be. Let's just end with a little bit of an outline of the Four Noble Truths. Mm-hmm. They are the essential principles in Buddhism. And it would be, I think, valuable for listeners to understand what the profound nature of these four noble truths.
Mm-hmm. So, Four Noble Truths was the first teaching of Buddha. And basically all teachings followed that. He said no true sufferings. So a lot of us are oblivious to the suffering that we're actually experiencing. It's just normalized. No true causes. What are the causes of our suffering? No true paths, which is actually the fourth of those. Mm-hmm. And then, no true cessations. How, you know, what is it really like to not suffer and to be happy mm-hmm. all the time? And, you know, you ask anybody, can you be happy all the time? And, well, of course not. Well, then you're right. If you ask somebody else that, can you be happy all the time? And they say, yes, of course. Then they're right as well. So our beliefs are self-limiting. Mm-hmm. And so we need to step back from our beliefs and say, okay, how can life be different? So.
Well, one of the principles on our show is there's no wrong answers to any of my questions, just to answer an issue that you raised earlier. And I think the important thing for us in addressing planetary issues is to embrace every answer. It doesn't mean that every answer leads to the same outcome. It just means that every answer and response is valuable and valid. Today, you've really laid out a wonderful, warm vision of not only your own heart, but of the heart that is in everybody that we can cultivate, we can actively cultivate. Mm-hmm. And by doing so, we can make the world, each of us contributes to making the world a better place.
Yeah, we all have love and compassion in our heart. They can all be developed further.
Absolutely. So, and it's scientific.
It's scientific.
Thank you, Mike, for joining us today in the studio.
Thank you.